Cairo, Seattle.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, Nora McInerney. Nora hosts one of my favorite podcasts, Terrible, Thanks for Asking. She's the author of the memoir, It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too. And she has two new books on the way. It makes it sound like she's pregnant with them. Available for pre-order now. Not from Nora's uterus. Is that where babies are? I need to take a sex ed class. I'll tell you more about those books at the end of the show. Nora's last meal is a sacred and much beloved food in her household. It's something her parents refused to buy when she was growing up, and something that she now serves to her kids with much fanfare, but only on the weekends.
I think that if I were never going to eat again, I would just want to eat a bunch of sugar and some milk. I really like milk still. I still drink milk with my dinner.
But milk has gone from cool to drool, from chic to geek, from glad to bad. So many people, in our country at least, have stopped drinking milk. When I order milk at a restaurant, the response from my friends seems to range from disgust to intrigue. So I chat with Mark Kurlansky, author of the book Milk, about why humans started drinking the breast milk of other animals in the first place.
Somebody said, hey, what about that goat over there?
And I chat with Angela Garbis, author of the popular book Like a Mother, about the magical, mysterious powers of breast milk. And this time we are talking about human breast milk.
The more I learned about it, the more I realized it wasn't just food. It was also medicine. And I found, and this to me is the heart of the story, is it's a nonverbal way that mothers and babies communicate.
And even people who won't drink milk in a glass will still pour it over their cereal. We'll learn the history of the iconic cereal Lucky Charms from its marketing manager over at General Mills. But first, my conversation with Nora McInerney. Nora's very popular podcast, Terrible Thanks for Asking, was born out of a very difficult, very sad time in her life.
So 2014 was a really big year for me, just in general. I turned 31, and then on October 3rd, I lost my second pregnancy. On October 8th, my dad died of cancer. And then on November 25th, my husband, a huge copycat, also died of cancer, but he had brain cancer. And to be fair to him, he had cancer longer than my dad. And then my dad decided to get cancer in like May of 2014. And he died real fast because he was just a more efficient person than Aaron was. And that was my 2014. So I'm fun. I'm a carefree, lighthearted person with a very good social life. But I basically, after that, had what I now can look back at and think, like, that was probably a little bit of a breakdown. But I quit my job, which is not recommended by most financial professionals when working with a widowed mother of a toddler who also has a mortgage. But I quit, and I wrote a book for HarperCollins called It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too. When the book was done, I started a nonprofit called Still Kickin' in honor of my husband and his favorite t-shirt, and just all the people in the world who are going through hard shit, which is literally everyone. And then I was like, I need a job, and I really like listening to podcasts, and I went on Twitter. And I said, does anyone in Minnesota make podcasts? And instead of being like, Google it, you idiot, someone said, you should talk to Hans Buto. And so I slid into his DMs and I said, I have an idea for a podcast. And he actually read the email. And then we met and we made our show, which is Terrible, Thanks for Asking, a rejected book title. Do you want me to keep going? I could really get into but that, I mean, I think that's what brings us here today.
I think so too. The first couple episodes of Terrible Thanks for Asking are Nora telling her story. But then the show shifts into Nora talking with other people who have gone through really difficult experiences. But because Nora is such an amazing storyteller and host, because she is profoundly charming and dedicated to keeping it real, and because the show is so excellently produced, the show manages not to be sappy or cliche. It's not sad for the sake of being sad. It can actually be funny at times. Can you talk a little bit about Aaron and your relationship and his personality?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Aaron, for me, being in my 20s was just like wandering from person to person being like, will you love me? Will you love me? Like, are you my person? Are you my person? It was just the worst. Honestly, my 20s were just a pit of despair. And when I was in that pit of despair, I met the funniest person I have ever met. And it was just a full-on cliche. It was just magic. And a year after we got together, he had a seizure at work, and it turned out he had a brain tumor, and he had brain surgery, and they told us it was cancer, and we got married 2 weeks later, and we had the most normal life. We just had a marriage where one of us, him, had his head sawed open twice and had a bunch of chemo and radiation, but you know, we had a baby, and we bought a house, and we went to our jobs every day, and we watched Game of Thrones. Like, things were just super normal and wonderful and perfectly dull, aside from the fact that he was dying.
Nora shares a lot of personal things about her life on her podcast and on her Instagram page and stories. So when I was preparing to interview her, it was sometimes hard to know what was okay to ask and what was overstepping my bounds. This podcast is not intended to be morbid. I use the "What's Your Last Meal" question as a catalyst to have conversations about what foods are really important to people. But since Nora has had people close to her pass away, and she deals with the topic of death a lot in her work, I wondered if she had experienced any real-life last meal moments with her husband, Aaron.
I mean, the last meal that we ate out, we did not know was our last time going out. Aaron got pancakes. That was like the day that he was told like that he was dying and he was on hospice. And we're like, okay, I guess we'll go to Bandbox Diner and get pancakes. Like, what do you do? Aaron, I know the last thing he ate was a frozen pizza, which he loved. And it makes sense that that was the last thing he ate. But it wasn't like, this is my last meal. It was like, this is the thing that I feel like I can stomach right now and that I really want. And then he never ate again.
And then since he's died, you got remarried and you had another child. And so can you talk a little bit about that? I think for people who are following along, they were like, wait, what? What's happening?
What? Yeah, is that allowed? Yeah, I fell in love about a year after Aaron died. I met this dude through my friend Mo, who's also a widow. And Matthew is my current husband. And he came with two children of his own. So my family has grown exponentially. I went from one child to four. We had those older acquisitions and we had a little bit of organic growth. Our baby is like 2 years old now. And we have a perfectly typical, atypical family, which is every family. Like every family that you thought was just looked so normal and like so perfect is really not. We have such a good family. Honestly, I don't want to brag, but like it's the best one out there. But our family came from, you know, two broken places and we look like a regular family with a minivan and we are. And all these kids have different biological parents and that does not mean that I love them any less or that they love each other any less. So it's really definitely expanded my understanding of what family can be and what love can do.
When somebody passes away, a lot of food starts coming to your home. And you live in the Midwest and you live in like Casserole City in Minnesota.
Call it hot dish.
Hot dish. Yeah, exactly. What is your feeling, opinion on hot dish?
I love anything that's carb and cheese based. I think it's wonderful. I think it is truly just a testament to the ability of people to survive in like negative 20 degrees that we can put a bunch of food in one dish, bake it, and have it be so dense that like we don't have to eat for another day. I did not eat any of the hot dishes that were brought to me after Aaron died at all. But I love a hot dish. I wasn't raised on them. My mom was not like a typical like Midwestern mom cook. Like before being like a foodie was really a thing, like she would read like fancy food magazines and make us food out of those magazines, which I thought was disgusting and I hated. And now I look back, I'm like, oh, that was so beautiful of her. She made these beautiful meals. And I was like, I don't want to eat. Give me a potato. So yeah, I'm very pro hot dish. I would like to learn how to make more of them. My current husband makes hot dish for the kids. He makes tater tot hot dish regularly. That's a staple for our house, which is some sort of cans of condensed cream of something soups, ground burger, and then tater tots on top so that they're all sort of like baked to a crisp. But I'm missing an ingredient. Just ends up looking like cat food. There's so much sodium and so many like preservatives that it's delicious.
The ingredient she may have been missing was a canned vegetable. Hot dish, or as the natives like to call it, hat dish, is Midwestern speak for casserole. And according to Howard Moore, the author of How to Talk Minnesotan, it was invented by, quote, budget-minded farmwives looking to feed their families as well as congregations in the basements of the first Minnesota churches. So the basic formula for hot dish is a meat, a vegetable, a starch like wild rice or potatoes or pasta, any cream of whatever you want soup, and a crispy topping like tater tots or crushed potato chips. And it remains a very popular one-dish meal for folks in Minnesota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. So here is the timeline, according to Food & Wine magazine. The first record of hot dish was in the Grace Lutheran Ladies' Aid Cookbook from Mankato, or Mankato, we've got a tomato-tomato situation here, folks, in Minnesota in 1930. That recipe calls for 2 pounds of hamburger, Cremette brand elbow macaroni, and canned peas. But 4 years later, in 1934, Campbell's introduced its line of condensed cream soups, and they instantly became a hot dish staple. So much so that cream of mushroom is often referred to as the Lutheran binder. Not like a binder full of women, but more like this soup binds together this crazy hot dish.
Timely binder reference.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm up on politics and trends in America. In 1953, Orida invented the tater tot, so housewives started topping their hot dishes with those crispy potato nuggets. And I have to add one more dish here, because as I was researching hot dish and clicking through links in different websites, I ended up on a Wikipedia page for something called Snickers Salad. This is another Midwestern and apparently Iowan potluck staple that is served alongside hot dish. Snickers salad is a layer of vanilla pudding and whipped cream with layers of chopped Granny Smith apples and chopped up chunks of Snickers bars. The Midwest also has something called cookie salad, and I'm convinced that these people don't know what a salad is. When we come back, Nora will share her last meal and we'll learn the history of Lucky Charms. So what would your last meal be?
Okay, so I've thought a lot about this, and I think that if I'm being realistic with myself, like I had a couple questions, like one, is it a meal I have to make myself? Two, would someone else make it? I think either way, the answer would be an entire box of Lucky Charms with whole milk.
Whoa! Why Lucky Charms?
They're just the best. They're okay, so I wasn't allowed to eat sugar cereal growing up. It's so good. It's so good, especially if you don't let it get soggy and the marshmallows are still kind of crisp, but set against that like really fatty, ice cold milk. The milk has to be very, very cold. And then afterwards you drink the cereal milk and it's slightly pastel and it's so good. And I never have one bowl of Lucky Charms. In fact, if we have a box of Lucky Charms in our house, I put it on the very top shelf so the kids can't reach it. And it's reserved for Saturdays and Sundays only. And it will be gone in a day. One day, it'll be gone. And the thing is, I know this about myself. I could eat that whole box. That would not be hard for me. And some milk. I really like milk still. I still drink milk with my dinner.
I do too. People are so weird about it. Adults do not like milk.
It's very good.
It's very good. And I feel like it went out of fashion. And the one place there is no milk that I don't understand why there's no milk is on the airplane. They never have milk. What about the children? I always want milk because I love it with anything salty and carby. So like when you get your like free, you know, pretzels or whatever, all I want is milk. And they don't have it.
They don't have milk on the airplane. No. I never noticed that. And now I'm going to be contacting Delta on our behalf.
And so since you weren't allowed to have it as a kid, when did you discover Lucky Charms?
Oh, I mean, in college when I discovered that I could buy my own groceries, I was so into grocery shopping in college. I loved it. Made me feel so adult to like find the friend who had a car, drive to the grocery store together, like bag our groceries, put them in the trunk of a car, go home, put them away. I loved that feeling. So In college, I really did buy responsible groceries. I'd buy like frozen chicken breasts because they were cheaper than fresh ones. I would buy not sugar cereal, but every once in a while, I would buy a box of Lucky Charms and I would eat the whole thing. It's not as if the box is filled to the brim with Lucky Charms. Inside the box is a bag. Inside the bag is a lot of air. So it's really like half a box. And then I think everybody should have like an aunt and uncle who are like the magical like family members, like where maybe your parents aren't always fun, but you have this aunt and uncle who are always fun. Like when you go to their house, it's just always fun. My aunt and uncle, Mo and Di, when we slept at their house, they would take orders. Like before we arrived, they would be like, what do you want to drink? What do you want to eat? And they would ask what kind of cereal we wanted. And they would let us destroy boxes of sugar cereal upon arrival. And all day, all night, whatever we wanted, we would get. And I thought about that when Matthew and the big kids and Ralph and I all moved in together. I just remember thinking like, oh, that was like a special part of my childhood. And I'm going to get like a special cereal for us. I'm going to get us a special cereal, something that I wouldn't normally buy. Because obviously, you know, I had Ralph and he was my firstborn and I was, you know, very optimistic. Like, oh, he's going to be the kind of kid who never eats anything processed and doesn't have any sugar. Yeah, right. I broke that pretty quickly. Like as soon as he could recognize like the golden arches, I could recognize that it would keep him quiet. He was eating McDonald's. So yeah, it kind of became a thing when we became a family, all six of us. And I remember thinking that it was so cool that the big kids sort of like went along with the fact that it wasn't an everyday thing. Like it was a special thing. And I love that. Like I know even today, this morning, like our baby is now two and he doesn't have a huge vocabulary, but he loves charms, Lucky Charms, charms. And this morning he woke up and was like, charms, charms. And Ralph is five and was like, nope, it's not Saturday. No, no charms. Not happening. You're not getting any charms today. So
that's awesome.
Frosted Lucky Charms.
They're magically delicious.
I am very familiar with this jingle, but one thing I'm not familiar with is the sensation of Pink Heart marshmallows between my teeth. I have never had Lucky Charms before.
This, Rachel, is insane to me.
I have actually been thinking about doing another. Well, I don't want anyone to steal my idea, but basically my idea would be for a podcast of adults trying things they never had as children, because so many things come up on this show that I have never tried before.
That is a great idea. And legally, now you own it.
Yay. Is this the equivalent of like the self-addressed stamped envelope?
Yes, you've mailed it to yourself.
Okay. So I got a little Lucky Charms. We have this tiny little store in the basement of the radio station. It's one of those one serving cups with the peel off lid. I got some milk. So I figured in order to, you know, really get into this episode, I have to try it first. I just wasn't allowed to have sugar cereal as a kid, like a lot of kids. And then when I became an adult, apparently I just was a boring cereal person. I never cared to try sugar cereal. So I've had I think I've only had one other sugar cereal.
Did you enjoy it? Did you like the one you had?
I did like Captain Crunch.
Okay.
And I've had, if this counts, I've had Honey Nut Cheerios. Does that count?
It's sweet.
Yeah, it's sweet. Sure. Honestly, this doesn't appeal to me. The idea of crunchy marshmallows doesn't sound good, but I just peeled off the top here, so we're going to try it. Okay, the marshmallows are a combination of cute and janky. Like this marshmallow.
Oh, that's a whack rainbow.
But then look at this rainbow. They're totally different shapes.
Beautiful.
Okay, ooh, blue moon. All right, I'm going to pour the milk.
So what is your milk cereal strategy? How do you do it?
I kind of like the cereal a little soggy,
okay.
Honestly, like with Cheerios even, so I usually let it sit for a minute. I think, and I don't know how this makes sense, that these little cups of cereal taste better than a bowl of cereal.
Really?
I think because the cereal's condensed into a small area, there's something about the denseness that I like. I don't know how to explain it.
I like pouring milk into the cereal until it becomes visible. And then when I can see the milk start to come up through the cereal, that's when I'm done.
That's when you stop. So you don't cover the cereal.
Correct.
Okay, I'm going to pour now. Ooh, I like when it pops up to the top. That's good. Okay. And then you have to kind of smush it back in because of the density. So are the marshmallows supposed to stay crunchy, or do you want them to get soft?
I'm not sure that they're supposed to be crunchy necessarily, but they will stay sort of firmish, you know?
Ooh, the milk's already kind of blue and kind of green. That's fun.
Bite one.
Bite one. I forgot to mix marshmallows with oats. I only did oats.
So let's get the oat response.
The oat response was good. It just tastes like Honey Nut Cheerios.
Okay.
Hmm. Oh. It really tastes like marshmallows.
Yeah.
This is not as bad as I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be sickly sweet. It's kind of good. I wouldn't buy it, but I don't mind it. Do you want a little cereal?
Yes.
Separate spoons, if you're wondering.
Oh, sweet mother.
One thing it also does expertly is leaves you with that, like, sweet milk at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's real nice.
Yeah, Christina Tosi has definitely taken advantage of that with her cereal milk concept, like turning it into soft serve at Milk Bar.
Oh.
Yeah, and making desserts with the cereal milk as an ingredient.
Smart.
So smart. Okay, so now that I can relate to Lucky Charms, we can move on with the episode. Let's talk about charms. What is the history of Lucky Charms? When was the cereal born?
That was a long time ago, back in 1963. So one of our developers, he was messing around in our kitchens and mixing together some of his favorites. He mixed together Cheerios with some sliced up pieces of his favorite candy, Circus Peanuts. And that was the beginning of Lucky Charms.
That is Joanne Knight, Senior Marketing Manager for Lucky Charms.
Is it true that you were the first to use marshmallows in a cereal?
Absolutely. Lucky Charms is the original OG marshmallow cereal.
So for the first few years, Lucky Charms was actually made with Cheerios, but then they switched over to frosted oats in five different shapes.
They're bells and fish and arrowheads, clover leaves and crossbars.
What is a crossbar? Erin Mason, you've been eating Lucky Charms your whole life. What is the crossbar shape? Is that the little cross?
Yeah, I think it's like an X on its side.
It's like a plus sign. But I noticed that there are fish-shaped oats, and there is this cross-shaped oat. So I was wondering if there was a little bit of a Christian influence in Lucky Charms. I am a cereal sleuth. Anyway, once they replaced the Cheerios with sweetened oats, sales increased. And then there are the marshmallows.
We call our marshmallow bits Marbits because marshmallow bits are really long to type and write. But that's how we fondly refer to all the marshmallows in our Lucky Charms.
So when I was looking online, I was surprised to see how many marshmallows have been added and subtracted over the years. I don't know if I want to have you sit here and just start listing off, you know, all of them, but how far away are we now from the original marshmallow lineup? What are some of the big moments in marshmallow history of ones that have come and gone?
Yeah, so we have a number of limited editions over time, but I want to focus you in on kind of how we've added and subtracted marshmallows into our permanent eight. So originally we started with that four that I talked to you about, those pink hearts, yellow moons, green clovers, and orange stars. 1975 was when our first permanent marshmallow was added, and that was the blue diamond. And then it took us 8 more years to add another new one, which is purple horseshoes. In 1989, for our 25th anniversary, we added the red
iconic
balloon.
Rainbow
in 1995,
marshmallow.
We replaced our yellow moons with those green clovers, but then that is in Lucky Charms today. So we have hearts and stars and horseshoes, clovers and blue moons, rainbows, tasty red balloons, and now our magical unicorn.
Can you talk a little bit about the science of these marshmallows? Obviously, they're very different than the puffy marshmallows that you would buy to make s'mores with. Are the Lucky Charms marshmallows dehydrated?
Well, our recipes are quite a secret, so we don't want to share any of Lucky's magic, but they are definitely marshmallows that make sure that we can, they taste delicious in cereal with and without milk.
Right. And speaking of Lucky, Joanne talks about the cereal's famous mascot.
LC Leprechaun, as he was originally known, but more fondly, as we like to call him, Lucky, actually started and has been the mascot of Lucky Charms from the beginning. He was first seen on boxes in 1965, but he was featured in advertising throughout. Although there was one little blip in 1975 when we had a brief hiatus where in New England, our marketers thought it would be fun to add Waldo the Wizard as our new mascot. We are very thankful that New England was not so keen on Waldo, and Lucky has been remaining as our clever and mischievous little mascot ever since.
General Mills makes a lot of cereal. All the cereals that we grew up with. They do Kix and Wheaties, Trix, Cocoa Puffs. But Lucky Charms are one of the top five most popular brands, alongside Frosted Flakes, Cheerios, Cinnamon Toast Crunch, and Honey Bunches of Oats.
Everybody kind of has their way that they eat cereal, and some people like it soggy, some people like it to stay crunchy. Is there a recommended amount of milk or like a way you're supposed to eat cereal? I mean, I know everybody does it on their own, but I wonder if, you know, the brand itself has a perfect way that you're supposed to do it.
There is no perfect way, but I think as I eat my Lucky Charms, I really like to make sure I have the right proportion of charms and oat pieces on the same spoonful, so I get milk and oats and marshmallows all in the same bite.
How often do you eat Lucky Charms?
Probably twice to three times a week.
Do you guys have cereal all over the place at the General Mills offices?
Absolutely. We have cereal bars, and so you can find us eating cereal morning, noon, and afternoon.
It's like Joanne works in a office full of college students that are eating cereal for every meal. I remember in college eating cereal out of a mixing bowl. Did you ever do this? Just like pouring insane amounts of cereal in?
Yeah, like a half box bowl.
Yeah, and yeah. On sitcoms, they would eat with a mixing spoon, but I kept it classy and I ate with a regular size spoon. But I like to think that that's what Joanne does every day, like comes to work in her pajamas and just eats huge bowls of cereal. All right, time for a break, but when we come back, some really good news if you happen to be a lactose intolerant with bad self-esteem. We're looking for a very specific person here. And human breast milk is fascinating. It is magical, and it's kind of the original smart device. I know it's not a device, but this is going to make sense once we get to it. Writer Angela Garbies will talk about what makes breast milk so smart. We'll be right back. If you're going to talk about cereal, you got to talk about milk. But these days, a lot of people use milk alternatives like soy or almond milk or my personal favorite, oat milk, because they are lactose intolerant. And we treat lactose intolerant people like there's something wrong with them, like they have an allergy. But it turns out that those of us who can process milk are really the outsiders. Mark Kurlansky is the author of the book, Milk, A 10,000-Year Food Fracas. Just learned that word. Still don't know what it means, though.
There's an enzyme in the intestines that gives us the ability to digest lactose, which is a sugar, in milk. And we're pretty much all born with this enzyme. If you're not, you're in big trouble. But we generally keep it for about 2 years, and then it disappears. And then we no longer have the ability to digest milk because we can't digest lactose. So that's called being lactose intolerant, which is a name which sort of suggests a disease, but it's actually the normal condition. And only about 40% of people hang on to this enzyme and can keep digesting milk. And we're the abnormal ones.
60% of humans on this planet can't digest milk. So why did we start drinking the milk of other mammals?
It's, you know, the most normal thing to go get a gallon of milk from the store. But if you really think about it, it's really strange because, you know, people think it's disgusting to drink breast milk unless you're a baby. But this is just breast milk of other mammals.
Yeah. The trick there is that most people don't think about it. I would have loved to have been there. Nobody knows exactly when this happened, but at some point there was a baby whose mother had died. Her mother couldn't produce milk. And so, you know, the baby was in trouble and needed to get milk. And what do we do? And somebody said, hey, what about that goat over there? That was an amazing moment.
In the United States, cow's milk is obviously the norm, but Mark says most experts agree that cow's milk is not the best choice for human consumption.
If you think about what milk is, milk is something that the body creates for the young. So every animal's milk is designed for the digestive system of that species. And a cow's digestive system is nothing like a human. You know, they have multiple stomachs and they're just completely different. So their milk is not particularly well designed for the human digestive system. But then what is? It becomes a big argument. A lot of people go with goats, which aren't really that similar to humans either, but closer than cows. you know, and there's camel milk, and a lot of people think donkey milk is the best. It costs a lot of money to maintain an animal, any kind of animal. So the more milk an animal produces, the better the economics of it are. And that's why everybody goes with cows.
But before we turn to cows and goats and donkeys, we only drank human mother's milk.
I have had horse milk. When I was in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, they sell it in the stores, and it is disgusting.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like milk gone bad. It's thick and sour, very sour.
Does it taste like buttermilk?
I have not had buttermilk, so I'm not sure. I've had buttermilk biscuits.
I like the word because it's like a horse's name. Buttermilk?
That'd be a great name for a
horse. Sugar cubes? I had buttermilk once, and this is so embarrassing. I was just graduated from college, and I was in Greece, and we were in a bakery, and I ordered a glass of milk to go with whatever sweet I was eating. And the guy behind the counter gives me the milk, and my friends and I are all standing at the counter. I take one sip, and without even thinking about it, I just spit it back because I thought it was bad and rotten, but that is still no way to act. But it just was like... It was so gross that my body was like, no, out now. And it turned out it was buttermilk. Very, very sour.
Gross.
Yeah, it's no horse's milk. Anyway, breast milk from humans is the perfect food for baby humans. It has everything that a baby needs. It has vitamins and nutrients and fats. And if they are breastfeeding, babies don't even need to drink water. A few years ago, Seattle writer Angela Garbies wrote an article for the local alternative weekly. It's called The Stranger, and her article was about the magical powers of breast milk. Now, this article quickly became the paper's most clicked on article of all time, and through her research, she uncovered some truly fascinating things about breast milk.
So essentially, when an infant suckles at its mother's breast, a vacuum is created, and within that vacuum, the baby's saliva is sucked back into the mother's nipple, and there her mammary glands have receptors that read and interpret that saliva. So if a baby is sick and there are pathogens in that saliva, her mammary glands interpret that and compel her body to produce antibodies to fight that particular infection. And so the mother's body produces that and goes into the breast milk, and then the breast milk goes back out of the nipple into the baby's mouth and into the baby's system where it targets that infection.
I think that is so amazing. The breast milk becomes medicine for what the baby needs in that exact moment.
You know, we're always told when we pump milk to label the date that it was pumped, it's best used within the next 6 days. But she said that she recommends to her clients that they label it with the time. And that's because different hours of the day, you have different hormones circulating in your body, and those show up in breast milk. Things like tryptophan or melatonin, which are the things that make you go to sleep at night, those are going to be present in evening milk. Studies that have been done where people in nursing homes have been given cow's milk, and milk that was given to these older people that had been milked at night helped them sleep better than the milk that had been pumped during the day.
I also had no idea what the milk actually is or where it comes from in the woman's body.
Studies have shown that women mobilize fat from the gluteal femoral region first, which is the booty. So that would be the first place that the fat comes from. You turn those fat stores, which is all energy that's just hanging out on your ass. You melt that basically and turn it into this liquid that you feed your child with.
And back to Nora, who has had two babies herself and is raising four children that range from 2 years old to a couple of teenagers.
The teenager was saying the other day, he's like, I don't know, we just don't really have like a cool house to hang out at. And I was deeply offended. Like, absolutely, our house is cool to hang out at. Yes, it is. I'm so angry at you for saying that. And it came down to like, we don't have enough snacks. And my parents weren't really snack people. I guess I'm not a snack person, or I just don't think of that. And I also don't do any of the grocery shopping or any of the cooking, so I really don't think about it. But I'm like, really? It just comes down to snacks? Like, I'll get you snacks if that's what would make our house cool. Could I be more desperate?
What do you want? Make a list. Yeah. Just like you're an uncle, you can like have your kids fill out a rider and you can get them everything they want for their happiness.
What'll it take? What'll it take?
I feel that though, because I felt the same way growing up because my parents were kind of healthy and I had one friend and they just had this snack closet that it was like, you know, in 80s sitcoms, every time like, oh, we're cleaning up, and they'd shove everything in the closet and then open it and like basketballs are falling out and it's like a huge mess. Like this was their snack closet. Like you'd open it up and it was just like, ow, an Oreo hit me in the chin. Like it was heaven because my mom didn't buy that. And so I went to this girl's house
all the time. And she's actually one of like two people I'm still friends with from high school. And I think that the snacks have kept us together all these years.
I think so, too. I think so, too. So I had a friend like that. And oh God, we would go to her house after school and her mom would meet us like at the door with a pitcher of Kool-Aid. Like,
Whoa. You
know,
so wholesome.
Right. And, you know, that was not my house at all. And I wonder if there's something about that almost like gives you like more control around like junk food or something, because you could take it or leave it because it was always there. But I'm the one eating a box of Lucky Charms as my last meal.
And that was Nora McInerney's last meal. Listen to Nora's fantastic podcast, Terrible Thanks for Asking, wherever you get podcasts, like maybe where you found this one. You can order her current book or pre-order one of her new books on her website. It's www.noraborealis.com/book. So one of her books is called No Happy Endings. That comes out the end of March. And Nora will be touring that book alongside her podcast in March and April. And her other upcoming book is called The Hot Young Widows Club.
Yeah, The Hot Young Widows Club is a real group of people who've lost their person. I literally don't care if you were actually married, if it was your boyfriend, your partner, your wife, you're gay, you're straight. You are welcome to join at hotyoungwidowsclub.com. It's a place for people to actually talk about their dead person and about the hard things that they're going through.
You can find all the information you need at noraborealis.com. Don't forget the www. Thanks to Joanne Knight, marketing manager of Lucky Charms. Thanks to Mark Kurlansky. His book, Milk, a 10,000-year food fracas, came out last year. You should buy it. And thanks to Angela Garbies. Her book is called Like a Mother, a feminist journey through the science and culture of pregnancy. Her book also came out last year, and you should also buy it. You must have bought so many books. I tell you to buy every single... Do you think there's someone out there who has bought every single book because they're like, I'll do whatever you say. Do you?
There's got to be someone,
right? There has to be. This episode was produced by that guy who you just heard there, Aaron Mason, and me. Theme music by Prom Queen. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher. Leave us a review. It only takes a second, and it makes a big difference. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal.